Later this hour, the state of Hawaii will perform its first test of an emergency siren that will include a warning of a missile strike. The 11:45 a.m. test will be heard statewide and will now become part of the usual monthly testing of emergency warning sirens. It's the latest reminder that issues on the Korean Peninsula are closer to Hawaii than to the U.S. mainland. And although government officials and others are quick to say the threat of an attack on Hawaii remains extremely low, David Santoro is the director and senior fellow of nuclear policy programs at Pacific Forum CSIS. He spoke with my colleague Bill Dorman, who asked him whether North Korea's latest missile launch on Wednesday changes anything.
I don't think anything is different. I think this is just another demonstration of the fact that North Korea is able to strike the United States and other nations in the world far from where it is, that basically it's able to actually strike anyone with a nuclear tipped missile. So it's not any different. It's just another demonstration of its capability.
There's one line of thinking right now that says that this demonstrates now that North Korea can reach the continental United States, can reach the east coast of the continental U.S. in theory. So therefore, it's perhaps an end point to this period. Do you agree with that?
I do. I mean, I think that's right. And in many ways, you see a lot of assessments of the missile that was launched that demonstrates that clearly there's no doubt that now North Korea can strike, up to Washington or New York or, the East Coast. I think that they could even prior to that. This is just, again, a further demonstration that they can do it. It's just, it's a bigger missile. It's, it went higher than the previous one. So it's just further proof that they are able to deter and strike the United States.
But is there some sort of an opening now that this provides?
So I think what's different is that, not from a capabilities perspective, but what they've said is that they've completed their program.
Mm-hmm.
So you can see that in various ways. On the one hand, you can say, well, they're done, they're finished, they've got what they want, and now they, able to deter the United States, they're done. The other way to look at this is to think, well, maybe they are, sending a message saying, well, now that we're done, we, are prepared to engage and maybe negotiate something. Mm. Maybe, move on to a stage where we can, agree on some confidence-building measures, on something that, we would like to give and get from essentially the United States.
The initial reaction, certainly in Washington and in many capitals, UN Security Council as well, is, again, sanctions. A familiar road, something we've seen before. Right. Any sense, number one, we seem to be running out of things to crack down on, and number two, what's your overall view of sanctions right now?
So, I mean, I think strengthening sanctions is the right way to go.
Mm-hmm.
I think despite the fact that we have been strengthening sanctions for a long time, like you mentioned, we still can do a lot. We can ramp up sanctions much more than we have so far.
China on board for that?
China has been on board, has done more things. I think we have great expectations about China.
Mm.
We want China to do more. We want Russia to do more as well. I think they have been doing more. I don't think that China will push North Korea to the brink of collapse just because this is not in its interest.
Right.
But I think they're prepared to do more than they have been. And the president has been very clear that China has to do more. In terms of your second question on sanctions, I think that, yes, sanctions can influence behavior. I think we can, force North Korea to, sit down and maybe negotiate something. They are effective in influencing behavior. What I don't think they can do is they can change the course of North Korea.
Mm-hmm.
When you look, for instance, at what happened in Iran, the Iran deal that we concluded was, yes, done thanks to the sanctions regime that were imposed on Iran, but predominantly it was done because Washington was willing to negotiate on enrichment. So sanctions can help, but they cannot help alone.
Are we at a point where dealing with a nuclear North Korea is just a fact of life?
I think we are, and I think we have been for quite some time. I think North Korea is a nuclear-armed state.
And yet you still hear the rhetoric from Washington, I'm thinking from the Trump administration in particular, that we cannot allow North Korea to have ICBM, nuclear capability, missile delivery.
Right. No, that's true. They have them, though.
So where does that leave us? You're a strategist. You look at the big picture on this. So where does this leave us?
So I don't think we should accept it as something that I don't think we should accept it in the long term. I think we have to come to grips with the fact that it's a reality that we're going to have to deal with. And that means we need to enhance deterrence and defense against North Korea. We need to contain the threat. But we need to also agree to some form of, I would argue, dialogue to impose constraints on the program itself to eventually down the line get to a point where we can actually roll back that program. That program is a reality. We shouldn't accept it, but we should move towards some kind of a dialogue to actually reduce tensions.
Now, part of this mentioned previously China, Russia certainly with a role on this, and going back for some years with groups of various nations, but certainly Japan, South Korea playing critical roles within this. How do you see that progressing?
Right. No, absolutely. I mean, I think this is critical, and I think what I would not want the United States to do is to agree to some kind of a deal with North Korea without consulting its allies. I don't think that's what the United States is doing, but I think that promoting cooperation and coordination and consultations with Tokyo and Seoul is critical, just because they are U.S. allies. I think that in the short term, what we need to do is again enhance deterrence and defense, and that means strengthening the alliances with Japan and South Korea, and that means enhancing their defense capabilities, promoting cooperation not only with between the United States and Japan, between the United States and South Korea, but also between them.
And that is the area where it's been proven to be very difficult. There were recent naval exercises that were pulled back a bit in terms of the idea of this trilateral approach. That's a difficult situation.
It's proved very difficult, essentially for political reasons between Tokyo and Seoul. At the same time, though, over the past few years, we've seen a number of progress. There's greater intelligence sharing between the two, even growing consultation on extended deterrence questions. Always with the United States as the bridge, I guess, between them. But we've seen over the past few years enhanced trilateral cooperation, particularly when it comes to dealing with the North Korea problem. That's a good thing. I think we can do a lot more. And as a matter of fact, at Pacific Forum, we run a trilateral dialogue at the Track 1.5 level to try and enhance cooperation or coordination between the three. Because, very simply, if something happens in North Korea, a military crisis, automatically Tokyo, Seoul, and the United States will be involved.
Yes.
So it's better to actually, enhance that work.
When you look out over the entire situation on the Korean Peninsula and step back from a sort of a civilian perspective of what people should be looking for, what people should be attuned to or aware of, what would you mention on that?
The public specifically needs to probably pay greater attention to the developing nuclear threat, I would say. I think that, as you know, here in Hawaii, we hear that we need to, be prepared for a so-called nuclear attack on
Hawaii.
Well,
although, and CSIS is less than a 1% chance.
Exactly.
Certainly.
I was going to say,
yes.
It's a very remote possibility,
yes.
If only because North Korea knows full well that, if it strikes, whether with nuclear weapons or not, the United States, Washington will respond and will, like Nikki Haley said yesterday, completely destroy North Korea.
Also a question of targeting in terms of precision.
Absolutely.
In delivery, but yes.
Absolutely. So, Now, at the same time, I don't think it's useless to be more aware of mm-hmm. what's going on in Northeast mm-hmm. Asia, particularly for Hawaii. I mean, Hawaii is you know, close, well, relatively close to North Korea, closer than mm-hmm. Washington. So being aware of what's going on in North Korea is not unhelpful. I want to just reassure people that, you know, Hawaii is not going to be targeted by North Korea. The possibility of that happening is very, very, very remote.
So when you look yourself in terms of what comes next, what are you looking at in terms of importance?
So I think more sanctions, mm-hmm. definitely more sanctions. I would want to see more, again, cooperation between U.S. allies and with the mm-hmm. United States, greater a build-up in deterrence and defense. Because clearly the North Korea program is developing. We need to, you know, beef up defenses and deterrence. But I also would like to see some form of dialogue going on. Because, you know, whether we like it or not, like we just said, North Korea has nuclear weapons. And the way forward is going to have to be discussing with them or try and negotiate something. Doesn't mean we have to accept their nuclear armed status of North Korea. But I think if we engage in some form of a dialogue that leads to concrete results and at least reduces tensions and reduces nuclear dangers, I think, you know, this is progress.
We'll keep an eye out for that progress. Thanks so very much. David Santoro is Director and Senior Fellow of Nuclear Policy Programs at Pacific Forum, CSIS.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Inter Island Solar Supply, Kaiser Permanente, and Hastings and Bleedwell, a communication company.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up in the show, HSTA hits back at what it sees as an anti-union message. But first, your quiz. In today's Backyard Quiz, we're thinking of two steam locomotives that belonged to the former sugar plantation known as the Pioneer Mill Company. It was situated on Maui's west coast and started as a loose collective of sugarcane fields in 1860 by James Campbell, who was later joined by Henry Turton. When their competitor, nearby Lahaina Sugar Company, went bankrupt in 1863, Campbell and Turton bought its assets and formally began operating under the Pioneer Mill Company name. It was one of the first plantations to use a steam tramway for transporting raw sugarcane through the fields to the mill. These steam locomotives were made by Baldwin Locomotive Works in Philadelphia and shipped over from Los Angeles. The first locomotive, built in 1882, is named after a nearby city. The second locomotive was built in 1989 and is named for a nearby community. I bet that's 1889. Named after a nearby community, which also shares the name with a beach park today. Today we're looking at the names of these locomotives. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for today's programming comes from the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra, presenting Holiday Pops, featuring Amy Hanaialii and seasonal classics for all ages, 7:30 p.m. Saturday, December 9th at the Blaisdell. More at hisymphony.org.
Monday on this program, we ran an interview with Robert Ault of the Buckeye Institute, which describes itself as a free market think tank. In it, Ault claimed that public sector union members are being deprived of the right to choose their leadership and determine the direction their union takes. Mr. Ault framed his message as constructive criticism with a goal of empowering union members. Here's a sample of what he said.
It's something where I think a lot of them don't recognize that there could be the possibility of them having a choice, not a choice between unions and a choice as to whether or not they have a union representing them. And in large measure, I think that goes to, you know, a number that when I first heard it, I found it fairly startling, and that's that 94% of unionized workers in this country have never had the opportunity to vote for the union that's representing them.
And here's what Corey Rosenlee, president of the Hawaii State Teachers Association, had to say in response.
The truth of the matter is this, is that they do have a choice, and what I'm very proud of is that HSTA has elections every single year. We are a democratic union. We have elections for our chapter leaders. We have elections for our board of directors. And every 3 years, we have elections for our state leaders. And the interesting comparison is you look at his institute, the Buckeye Institute. First of all, it is not a democratic organization. And they are primarily funded by the Koch brothers. And so, you know, the big difference between the Hawaii State Teachers Association as a union and the Buckeye Institute is one, we're made up of 13,700 members who have the choice whether, one, they want to be in the union or not. Every member has that choice. And what I'm very proud of is that 97.5% of the teachers in Hawaii have chosen to be part of the union.
What motivates a think tank, a self-described think tank like this, to take a position like this and, you know, kind of, in effect, sound an alarm?
Well, they do have a very clear goal. And their goal is, you know, as sponsored by the Koch brothers want to go from billionaires to multi-billionaires. And the best way to do that is to get rid of anyone that's going to protect workers. What we've seen in our country is that income inequality has grown. And one of the big reasons for that is we've seen a decline in union membership. Across the country, what they've done is these right-to-work rules that have basically gotten or minimized unions. And it's very clear what their goal is. What they want to do is reduce worker wages, reduce worker benefits, and this will just help these large corporations and these, you know, barons to make even more money. And so if they can find any way to minimize unions, that's exactly what they're going to try to do.
All of the language of this particular criticism is couched in terms of benefit for people.
You know, the Buckeye Institute is not trying to both benefit workers, or what the Hawaii State Teachers Association tries to do is benefit our keiki in Hawaii. You know, I'll take them seriously when they're out there fighting to make sure that our classrooms are air-conditioned. I'll take them seriously when they're out there trying to make sure that our special education students have qualified teachers. They're not trying to do that at all. In all the states where they've done these things, what we've actually seen is the opposite. And I'll give you the example of Wisconsin. In Wisconsin, they basically weaken unions completely. And recently, a CNN article pointed out the what happened because of this. Wages decreased. Member benefits reduced by about 19%. And what happened, of course? Teachers started to leave. And what they've seen is a great reduction in the amount of qualified teachers that they have in Wisconsin. So the idea of weakening the union actually not only just hurts the members of the union, but also hurts the students and the teachers of, you know, in those states.
So why do it?
Well, it's very clear. You know, we've always been having this battle ever since the Industrial Revolution. And there are people that are not content with just having billions of dollars. They're trying to make sure they can have billions and billions of dollars like the Koch brothers. And the biggest opposition to them are the unions. We stand for workers' rights. You know, we try to make sure that, you know, we have qualified teachers in every classroom. So this has been a constant battle going on for, you know, 150 years in this country. And what Robert Ault does and the Buckeye Institute does is they try to find creative ways of attacking the union and making it sound good. But basically, they have the same argument. They just want to get rid of unions.
Since you mentioned the whole history of unions, let's go back maybe not quite 150, but let's go back 100 years and talk about the social changes that unions brought about in America, which were what?
So first of all, I'm a very proud social studies teacher.
Okay.
You know, and we have to go back and look at our history. You know, look at what unions have done for this country. We used to have children as young as five working in sweatshops. You know, we had seven-day work weeks. There was 12-hour work days. There were no benefits for workers. There's no paid overtime. There was nothing such as vacation leave. There was nothing less such as sick leave, you know. And the unions have fought and fought to make sure that we have worker protections in this country. And the thing is this. Research has shown that unions benefit not just the workers, but also in cases when you compare states where they have strong unions compared to right-to-work states, what you find is that educational outcomes are much better in these states with stronger unions. And the same thing happens not just in the United States, but in Europe as well.
Have you seen an anti-union trend, a pendulum swinging away from support of unions in America?
Well, when Robert Alt comes on the show, you know, he comes on and tries to say that, you know, unions are democratic. And, you know, the problem is that propaganda, you know, may sound good. And that's why it's so important that I, you know, when I heard that conversation, I said, we've got to respond to this. Mm-hmm. Because the propaganda tries to attack unions in really fake ways and false ways. We are democratic. And not only democratic, we're out there, you know, for the benefit of the keiki of Hawaii. That is what the Hawaii State Teachers Association does. And so this weakening of unions that's happening across this country has just – what we've seen in this country is the income inequality is getting much worse. The rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. And, you know, we need to have strong unions to protect those workers' rights.
Why would his – why would anti-union rhetoric be – It's often been quite effective, right? What is it that resonates?
Well, first they go after certain problems. And the most common problem we often hear something is like this. Well, unions protect bad teachers. And first of all, they never look to see the root causes of why we have, let's say, even a teacher shortage here in Hawaii. The problem is we just can't recruit enough teachers. And a lot of times it's because Hawaii teachers are the lowest paid teachers in the nation when you factor in cost of living. Now, so ask the question, how is that going to change? It's going to take collective bargaining. It's going to take the collective work of a union to try to improve the wages so that we can recruit more teachers, so that we can fill our classrooms and to be able to do that. But they're going to just keep on attacking and try to see what sticks. You know, and when I was listening to his argument, his constant refrain was, shouldn't people be able to choose their union? And the reality is they do. Every single year our members can vote. Every single year they can choose. We every year bring 400 teachers from across the state together in what we call a representative assembly. And any member can bring up what we call an MBI, which is basically a bill. And they can get that passed and try to get their colleagues involved in it and try to get past our representative assembly. And the purpose is that allows us to be a member-run organization. And so their whole idea is what they would love to see is a vote whether to get rid of the union every single year. And they know that if there's just one time where members vote to get rid of the union, then they don't have a union anymore and there's no one there to stop the Koch brothers and these corporations from just running wild.
You made a number of references to the Koch brothers and to opponents with a great deal of money. Far more than you have. How do you fight that?
And that's why sometimes they win. You know, we don't have billions of dollars. They've done some nasty things. They'll go to a state, and right before Christmas, they'll send out a flyer to every teacher saying, you know, what could you do with your union dues? You know, how many gifts could you buy instead of paying for them? You know, and they just keep on chipping away and saying fake and false things, and they try to say, just don't pay your union dues. Don't get involved. And the whole idea is that eventually that starts chipping away small period of time, start people believing it. And they have all this money to advertise and to have people like Robert Alt who will go across the country and they'll poll test certain themes and see if it works. And they start confusing people or muddying up the waters.
Corey Rosenlee is president of the Hawaii State Teachers Association, the union representing 13,500 public school teachers across the state of Hawaii. You can find that interview with Robert Ault of the Buckeye Institute on any of our previous interviews on the Conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org.
I'm Ira Flatow. This week on Science Friday, the FCC could soon vote to allow your internet service provider to charge you more for faster service. What the end of net neutrality could mean for the internet as we know it. Plus, how much will the new tax bill cost graduate students in extra taxes? There's an app for that, and you can run the numbers yourself. All on Science Friday from PRI.
This afternoon from 1 to 3.
Many of us remember our school years as a bombardment of information without much regard for our feelings, or at least without much guidance in how to manage our emotions. It can be a pretty turbulent time of life. But today, coping skills are being taught in the classroom in some Hawaii schools under the banner of a growing national movement, social and emotional learning. Courtney Teague is a reporting fellow for Civil Beat. She has the story in today's Reality Check. Good morning.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me on.
Well, you visited some classrooms where this is being done. What are they like?
Yeah, I did. So we went to Wheeler Middle School. There's about 800 kids on that campus, and 97% of them are from military families. So educators say that makes it tough for people to connect with their peers and connect with their teachers when they're moving around all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of teachers there are saying that this social and emotional learning curriculum has really helped. And what it is, it's pretty much in the name. It teaches kids to understand their emotions, to learn better social skills, to reflect on their behavior. And these lessons, they feature cartoon videos, journaling, discussions, fun stuff, not too much different on the surface from a lot of other classroom lessons. But the lessons are about rejection or anxiety, sexual harassment or friendships, a lot of difficult topics that are age appropriate.
At that age, a lot of things get, how shall I describe it? A lot of emotions get roiled up. It's the dawn of adolescence, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is a tough age. And a lot of teachers are saying that this curriculum, you know, by teaching kids to advocate for themselves, interact with their peers, they say that that can help them actually in the classroom. Managing anxiety, for example, helps them calm down if they're struggling during a test. And those are the kind of things that help kids advocate for themselves when they need some extra help. But, you know, a lot of people say simply it just teaches kids to be better people, and that's important too.
There's a term in your Civil Beat piece I haven't seen before, trauma-informed instruction. What's that?
Yeah, so this is another new concept that's really gained popularity in the past 10 years or so. So when you think of trauma, typically people think of some really dark, serious stuff, right? But here we're thinking of trauma as it could be anything from divorce to child abuse to homelessness or substance problems at home.
Mm-hmm.
Those are all sources of trauma. So trauma-informed instruction is really a change in attitude. So teachers are being trained to think when a kid acts out, it's not because they hate the teacher or it's just bad behaviors. It's a sign that they need help, and it's a sign that something is going wrong, maybe outside of the classroom, and they just need a little extra love.
Sounds as if behavioral science and academia are coming closer than they were previously, yeah?
Yeah, definitely. So this is something, like you mentioned, that is becoming more popular across the country. Again, we've really seen that change recently in the past 10 years or so. And a lot of Hawaii schools have had these opportunities because of $12.7 million in federal grant funding that three complex areas received, a couple of those on Oahu and also one on the Big Island. And in spite of all this great change, some people still say there's more to be done. They want more schools statewide to start using these kinds of practices. We have one DOE consultant that we talked to. He's been with them for a very long time. He says the Department of Education struggles to meet the needs of its disadvantaged students. While they do try to do so many of these great things, sometimes that can kind of trip them up because they're trying to do too many things at once, and it makes it hard for them to stick with some of these great initiatives.
Well, there's certainly plenty to be done, Courtney. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Every day we bring you a reality check from Civil Beat, today featuring reporting fellow Courtney Teague. And it's Friday, so it's time for us to check in with our news director, Bill Dorman, to see what the news department's working on this week. And it's December, but we've got the legislative session starting next month. Is it too early to start talking about it?
You know, never too early to start talking about the ledge, but it's interesting. Yeah, number one, it is December. But pretty astounding, as calendars go, 6 weeks from this coming Wednesday, and we're going to be in ledge session already. So now is the time that a lot of folks are in groups getting together thoughts, ideas, suggestions, and sort of, oh, here's some legislative agenda items. But there are a couple of themes that run through this. And so we'll be having more coverage along the way. But this coming week, for advocacy, folks who aspire to advocacy want to learn more about that. There's an event Monday Catholic Charities of Hawaii is running, and some state lawmakers are going to be involved in this about upcoming issues and in some education around how to advocate. The following day, the Hawaii Interagency Council on Transit-Oriented Development is going to present its strategic plan and, by the way, its funding request to the legislature as well. And so, again, just as we get towards the end of the year and the holiday season, certainly in terms of the pregame show almost for the legislature, you know, we're sort of about to be underway with that as well. So that's going to keep Wayne Yoshioka, our political reporter, busy for
a while. No doubt. You know, one of the things that we hear from our friends at the Public Access Room at the Capitol is that these weeks before the session begins are the time to really organize if you're going to push an issue, you know, advocate in a certain area. Now's the time to get the lay of the land.
That is true, and actually a shout-out to the Public Access Room because those folks can help you if you have questions in this area. It's a great resource, part of the Capitol, and it's a great piece of community education that's available out there as well. And it's free.
Exactly. And a different kind of advocacy is people volunteering over their vacation time.
Yeah, this is maybe in inevitable word creation, but voluntourism?
Okay.
Yes, exactly. the idea is pretty straightforward. You know, tourists spending part of their vacation time cleaning beaches and all. Sustainable Coastlines Hawaii has a new program with this. Kuvehi Hirishi is going to be taking a closer look at that, and we'll find out a lot more.
And you've got something going on the arts and culture beat as well?
Yeah. And imagine an island in the Asia Pacific, Isotopia Pacifica. Noe Tanigao, this is up at UH Manoa. She says some really elegant sculptures, installations as part of this. She's going to have a lot more on this next week.
All right. Thanks a lot, Bill.
You bet.
Bill Dorman is HPR's news director.
Looking for something uplifting? Look no further than the Atherton Studio, where on Saturday, December 2nd, HPR presents Big Island harpist Momi Riley. Her poetic lyrics, angelic voice, and the music of her harp will raise your spirits. Purchase your seat at hprtickets.org or call 955-8821 during business hours. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
It's Friday, which means we read your letters and emails. And after Tuesday's segment about the power dynamic associated with sexual harassment, Jennifer Familiani shared this, quote, "As a survivor of sexual assault, I'm intrigued by fighting the problem with tech, like the Callisto app that is being implemented on college campuses. While we wait for men to behave better, we can catch serial offenders way earlier, maybe victim three instead of dozens. Do this by offering a sexual assault reporting app that is safe, confidential, and non-judgmental. Collect stories from survivors. Empower them to tell their story. Offer personalized resources and support. Give them the option of only reporting to authorities if another reporter names the same perp. turning he said, she said into he said, they said, is an effective way to shift the cultural and power dynamic that has historically been letting rapists walk free. Michelle Kimura, HR manager at Kauai Coffee, had this to say. I was just listening to HPR and heard a conversation regarding the most recent sexual harassment situations that have surfaced. The comment was made that HR professionals are trained just to smile and sweep it under the rug. That is totally not true. I have been in HR for over 25 years, and when someone brings a complaint of this nature, all else on my desk takes second place. Most good HR professionals do not care about covering up for the employer, but more for doing the right thing, which means investigate and, if need be, go over the CEO if he or she is involved. I truly take offense and want you all to know it is a very discriminating comment about HR professionals. After yesterday's panel discussion on the state of mental health treatment in Hawaii, we heard this.
This is Mitch Berman calling from Maui. I just want to say something about the funding for mental health. I think people really should look at California's Bill 63, which gave 1% of anyone making over $1 million goes to mental health. And it provides a base for mental health rather than money going in and out, sort of like an accordion. And I remember when the ACT team, which was very effective and was really helping people who had severe mental illness, was cut during the downturn. And it creates a very flighty kind of financial support for mental health. It's not like the fire department or police department that have a clear line item budget. Okay, thanks. Aloha.
We thank you for the feedback. You can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org, reach out via social media on Facebook or Twitter, or call our talkback line at 792-8217.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, whose Kidney Cars program provides funding for community health and education services. Learn more about vehicle donation at kidneyhi.org.
When the state of Hawaii was young, voter turnouts in the islands were among the highest in the nation. But the last few voting cycles have seen an increasingly dismal level of voter participation.
When I look at issues of civic engagement, I see it through four lenses. The first is logistics, the second demographics, the third politics, and the fourth culture. So when you look at the first logistics, those are the things that legislatures and secretaries of state can enact, whether it's online voter registration or same-day registration. There are things within the mechanics of the election system which we can do to lower the barriers to participation. The second, when you look at demographics, it's pretty well known. The political science research is out there that the younger your voter population, they tend to turn out less. Also in places where there's significant ethnic diversity, you also see lower levels of participation. The third, when you look at politics, is this a single-party state? Are there opportunities for a state to be considered a swing state during national elections? That tends to turn out voters as well. And then finally, culture. Is there a culture of civic participation that even with those other three things being held constant, is this a place where people understand, no matter what, whether it's a known election outcome or not, that we are a people who vote? And so when you look at Hawaii through those four lenses, there are things on the logistics side you've done well. I mean, you have online voter registration. Certainly, you could look at some things about same-day registration. We in California just passed automatic voter registration. When you register to get your driver's license, you're automatically registered to vote in the state. But when you look at some of the other issues of demographics, there are certainly some challenges there. When you look at politics, this is a one-party state, to be sure, but it's been that way for a long time.
Yeah.
And some of these trends on decreasing voter turnout have really only manifested themselves in the last 15 to 20 years. And then finally, culture. Is this a culture where voting is held as something to be particularly important as a responsibility, and I think there's probably some work to be done there.
All those four categories are reasons to say my vote won't make a difference. Right.
Yeah, and
that's what people say to themselves.
Right, and so the political science term for that is rational ignorance, right? that it's rational be ignorant of politics if you believe that your single vote isn't really going to make much of a difference. At the same time, in looking at some of the data from Hawaii, there are local elections that are decided by 15, 20, 40 votes, right? And
yeah.
So
it's
certainly understandable if a Hawaiian voter says, well, my one vote's not going to make a big difference in the presidential election. But you look at some of these more local races for school boards and for council races and for even state legislative races, and your vote really does make a big difference. And I say this as a Californian who understands that even in local races, these are significant turnouts. So Hawaiians, I think, especially when you look at the more local level, there's a reason to fight that rational ignorance.
Well, if you're a young potential voter, whether you vote or not and what you vote for has an effect on the whole rest of your life. You
know,
in a way, you have more motivation to vote than an old guy who's only looking at 10, 20 years. Who cares after that, right?
Well, I think that's true. But this isn't just a Hawaiian problem. These are the national data shows that 18 to 28 cohort across the country is the one that votes less than any other age demographic. But you're so right that when you're looking at issues of education policy and tax policy, the issues that really you can deal with at a more local level, the younger voter really has a lot more on the line than those who've already had their kids go through the school system. They're
exactly.
No longer hiring people out of the education system, so on. You're absolutely right. A much better argument could be made to the younger voter that you have a lot more at stake.
But it hasn't been made or isn't getting through or, you know, what's going on?
Well, and I think in part this conversation around so much of our politics being nationalized and federalized is a challenge that when I'm speaking to groups about why people should vote, really my first commendation is to go local. Do you know who your mayor is? Do you know the difference between a city council and a school district? Because so many of the issues that affect our everyday lives, from filling potholes to what our police officers do to what happens in our school systems, they're all determined at the local level. And then once you get engaged at a local level, I find that people will then begin to find out, okay, there are some things that happen in Washington that affect me locally, but you have to start locally.
In a local government office, be it an assemblyman or a city council member or that, they have a tremendous amount of interest in any constituent contact because at the level where they don't have that many, I can speak from experience, if a constituent calls a state house or senate office, they're going to get a response.
Yeah, right? Yeah. No, it's absolutely right. I mean, I'm a big believer in federalism and the understanding of subsidiarity where you push as much as you can in policymaking down to the more local level, because not only do you get a chance to customize the policy to the places where you live, but you also are much better able to hold your elected officials much more accountable.
You know, in Hawaii, a frequent path to public office is a neighborhood board.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
those are volunteer boards, and they spend a lot of time on it. And that's about a traffic light where kids cross the street on their way to school.
Yeah. No, and in Los Angeles, where I'm from, we have neighborhood councils, which was that whole process was really started because there was a time at which there were many people in parts of what was traditionally the city of Los Angeles that just felt that the city council was not adequately representing them. So they wanted to find a mechanism that more localized the decision making, and that's where neighborhood councils start. And you see there as well, in much the same process, the people that get engaged in their neighborhood council work their way into elected office. But again, those are places where the vast majority of the policy decisions that affect us on an everyday basis are made much more locally.
What you also need to make that formula work is people at the local level with an appetite for public service, which is a job that takes a lot of time and doesn't get you rich if you do it right.
Yeah, you know, and I think that's one of the things that I try to do as I get around the country to speak is to say that you know, all this survey data is out there to show the declining levels of trust that we have as Americans in our governing institutions. But that one body that still retains higher levels of trust is local government. And so in that, you know, finding the people that are willing to throw their hat in the ring, I ran for office myself in an ill-fated statewide campaign in California back in 2014. It's a tremendous experience and one that is a freedom we really should realize. So I'm encouraging people all the time to get involved in elected politics, even if they have a big full-time job and they're doing something else or they're doing things with their family. The decisions that affect their lives are really often determined more locally, and it's worth engaging there.
When you ran for office, you ran into the issues of campaign funding,
yeah,
and campaigning and just how to make the engine run, didn't you?
I did. I was outspent 8-1 in my race, and I ran. I had never run for office before and had run against someone who had been in politics for most of his career. And I learned firsthand the advantages that incumbents, he wasn't an incumbent to the office, but he was an incumbent in the sense that he had been in elected office for about 15 years or so. There really are advantages to being, to seeing your career as one of being a career politician, so to speak. You build relationships in fundraising, certainly special interest, you have those relationships as well. And those all played a role in my race. But what I would say as well is that we're entering a unique time in American politics where, whether it's our president or the great campaign that Bernie Sanders ran, that outsiders are being considered more seriously. And I think in this time that outsiders who don't have those relationships, who aren't sort of tarred and feathered by those relationships, are being taken more seriously by voters.
Well, let's hope that they voters take them more seriously in return. Right?
Yes, yeah. And I think they will. I mean, I think really we're in a time where people who have not been involved in politics, that there's this, I really don't think it's a sustainable path that we're on when we look at the data about declining levels of trust. When you look at how we view Washington, D.C. or our state governments, I just don't think it's sustainable. And I think increasingly outsiders who have just become fed up with the system are going to step in the arena. I heard last night that there, in this 18 election in here in Hawaii, there are going to be some outsiders, first-timers that are running. And I see that increasingly happening around the country, whether it's local level or state level. And I encourage people to really consider, again, running for office. And I think voters are more open to looking at people who have private sector experience or nonprofit experience and are passionate and serious and authentic about the issues they care about.
Pete Peterson is the dean of Pepperdine University School of Public Policy. Prior to this, he served as executive director of the Davenport Institute for Public Engagement and Civic Leadership at Pepperdine, where he remains a senior fellow. He was the 2014 Republican nominee for California Secretary of State.
Aloha, I'm Cindy Goldstein with Hops, Homebrewers on Pacific Shores. our local Oahu Homebrew Club. If you want to listen back to a show, visit the conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org.
President Trump promised during the campaign that he was going to put coal miners back to work. Campaign's over, so how's it going?
I fell into the common error that, you know, I thought that the day Trump got elected, my troubles was over.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. We check in on coal country and bring you the rest of the day's business news next time on Marketplace.
This evening at 6, following All Things Considered.
Steam locomotives have a strong presence in Hawaii plantation history. Today, many of them are retired and on display or refurbished for tourism purposes. Two of the first steam locomotives used in plantation farming belonged to the Pioneer Mill Company on Maui and were used to transport sugarcane from field to mill. They were built like many other plantation steam locomotives at the time, with wheel construction categorized as 042. This meant that the railroad engine cars had no leading wheels, four driving wheels, and two training wheels to propel the engine car forward. After more modern transportation technology was brought in, an avid train collector named Robert Day shipped the two locomotives from West Maui to Southern California in 1952. They were brought back to Maui and donated to the Lahaina Restoration Foundation in 2011. Today, you can see both these locomotives, called Lahaina and Launiu Poco, on display at the base of the Pioneer Mill Company's restored smokestack on Lahaina Luna Road in Maui. And our winner today is Blake Perwin, an 11th grader from Kihei, who just learned this in his history class. So that's what you get for paying attention, Blake. Congratulations, you're today's winner. And that's today's quiz. If you've got one for us, you can send it to us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Bush Consulting, Sacred Hearts Academy, and Urgent Care Hawaii.
And that's it for this week on The Conversation. Coming up next week, Representative Tulsi Gabbard will join us to talk about proposed legislation to empower survivors of sexual assault and hold sexual predators in Congress accountable. We'd like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave us your comments at this number, 808-792-8217. Email is talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at The Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation. You also can find us on Instagram at The Conversation HPR. If you want to hear today's show again, get another past show, or links to more information, go to the Conversation page on the HPR website. Our program is produced by Lillian Song, Ryan Finnerty, and Amber Kahn. Our intern is Emily Cardinale, and our quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello. I'm Chris Vandercook. Join us next week for The Conversation.